It's me, Alison Spittle. You're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show. It's the 5th of November where I am right now. I know it won't be that day when you're listening to this, but this is the day that it is. It's the 5th of November. There's loads of fireworks going off. And also, I have a flatmate that teaches music. And it's lovely. It's lovely. But if you hear any kind of singing or anything like that, it's just my flatmate. It's nice to explain this stuff. I tried to do it in the toilet, recording-wise, but it was too echoey, and also I felt weird. You know, because I live with people, and I don't want them to think that I just podcast while on the toilet. So, we're here in my bedroom. This week's guest is Stephen Colfer. He's an amazing man. He's an actor. He's one of the guys behind the Irish phenomenon Dream Gun. Which is like, they used to do like sketches. They're really funny. You can find them on YouTube as a part of the Firehouse Film Festival, which is coming to an end, by the way. The Firehouse Film Festival, we've only got two more showings of the Firehouse Film Festival, and I'll tell you more details about that after. Also, big announcement, I'm going on tour in Ireland again, and I'm very excited. Very, very excited. Just after clicking yeah, that's grand, the auto reply on a Gmail about my posters. And also, if I'm not that coherent, I'm so sorry. Well, I'm so tired, and I've been working all day, and I was writing something, and when you write for a long time, your brain goes to shite. Like, I got Taskmaster waiting for me now, and I'm gonna watch that and go to sleep, and I'm gonna have a great time. Also, do you know what? Let's chat after, all right? Because it's been 2 minutes and you've been lovely. So I'm going to tell you about my tour and about the Irish Podcast Festival, 16th of November, just in case you don't listen at the end. 16th of November in the podcast studios on Lombard Street. My guests are Maya Dunphy and Julie J. Okay, goodbye. I'll see you soon. Stephen.
Hi, Alison.
So you're, what would you describe your job as?
My business card says actor, writer, producer. I spend most of my time producing.
Really?
Yeah, these days, definitely. Mostly because I do most of the producing for Dream Gun.
Right.
So that's kind of the stuff that I've learned more since I started doing Dublin Fringe, because I've kind of done that side of things every time.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, I think the nature of shows like Film Reads, where it's, you know, once we have the script written, you know, it's almost like it's got the same level of prep as like an improv show does, you know, like we just have to, as long as the actors are going to show up on the day and we print the scripts, that's kind of the production of the show itself done. So
yeah.
Everything else is just like sending emails, booking venues, you know, buying insurance, all that stuff tends to be what I do mostly, because that's the kind of stuff you just have to do. You sit down at your computer at 10 and you just wait for whatever email comes in that's going to have a problem with you today.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and you
yeah,
deal
yeah.
with it. You know, that's what it is. That's what I do most of the time.
And so, yeah. What was your first thing that you had to produce?
The first thing would have been Chaos Theory, which was Dream Gun sketch show.
Okay.
And this would have been...
And describe that sketch show for me, because it's like different. It's like, do you have to roll a dice or something? Or
So it was based on, there's a group in Chicago called the Neo Futurists, and they have this amazing method for like writing new sketches that, like, when I first saw it, this was in 2011 when I was in college, I was like completely enraptured by it, where they do 30 sketches, and at the end of the show, so it's on a Friday and a Saturday, they do 30 sketches, and at the end of the show, they throw a big fuzzy dice into the audience, who then throw it back to them, and whatever that dice lands on is the amount of sketches they have to jettison and replace with new sketches for next week's show.
Wow.
And that's it. They do that. So they do it in seasons. So they start with 30 and then over the course of it they'll write maybe another 60, and then it, you know, and then that season is over. And the way they do the show every night is literally the sketch titles are just up on a big washing line above them and they just pull them down at random. So I was like, ooh, there's something about this I really like. I don't want to just rip it off, but yeah, I want to do something like it. So what we did was we had a show called Chaos Theory, which is sketches written by Dream Gun that were all kind of loosely circulating around the idea of probability and chaos. And literally at the beginning of the show, we shuffled a deck of cards that had each sketch written on it and just did them in the order that they came out.
Mm.
So while the sketches were the same every night, the order of the show was different.
Okay.
Yeah, and stuff like the curtain call and the actual introduction where we explained the show were sketches mixed into that order. So you could start the show, and if you didn't get the introduction to it until late in it, you wouldn't quite be able to figure out what was going on until that came up. It was very, audiences responded to that differently depending on which night of Edinburgh Fringe you were at.
Yeah.
But it was definitely like, it was like a crazy show in terms of like producing, because it was just, all right, we have to get a show to Edinburgh Fringe. Because it actually, Chaos Theory didn't play Dublin Fringe. And we just had no idea how. So we made like every mistake that you can make.
Right.
You know? Like we thought that, you know, I think a lot of like Irish acts make this mistake because Dublin Fringe is a curated festival and you go to Dublin Fringe and you fill out the application form. And then if you get in, they're like, oh, congratulations, you're on at 7 p.m. on Tuesday in Smock Alley Theatre. There's your run.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas in Edinburgh, you have to go to venues, get a yes from them first. And then once you have that, you go to Edinburgh, the Edinburgh Festival, and make that show part
of the
Edinburgh Festival Fringe. Mm. You know, so it's like the order is reversed. And we just went straight to Edinburgh and we just like pulled out their application form and filled it in, thinking that like, oh, we're just going to type in our ideal venue here.
No.
You know what I mean? Like we just did that initially, like, because we didn't know. And like, this is the thing, like, nobody stops you from doing these things.
No.
You know? As Mitchell and Webb said, the whole world is just people walking into rooms, you know? Like,
yeah,
if you try to fill out that application form, it's going to go all the way into Edinburgh Fringe, and someone's going to have to read it and go, this doesn't make any sense. You know? So we kind of did that initially, and then 2 months later we were like, oh, we borked it, and like last minute fixed it.
Oh my gosh.
But little things like that, you know, it's just the whole job has just been doing
it's the
things
learning
like that
experience.
And then getting a phone call 2 months later being like, you should have done it this way. And I was like, well, why wasn't that written down?
I feel like Edinburgh is like a place where you're not in on the secret, and then you find out a little element of the secret at the end of the Fringe, and then you have to go back and do it again.
Yeah, you get a little bit more every time.
Oh, your knowledge.
And then every time you're like, this time it's not going to get me. And then it just finds a whole new way to kick you in the face somewhere along the run.
So, yeah. Where did you grow up?
I
know nothing about you, Stephen.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah,
well,
here
we go, Alison.
I know.
Yeah, I grew up in Kilkenny.
In Kilkenny Town.
John Doran and John Morton and all the Devious Theatre crew. I'm another one of them.
What?
Yeah, so this like massive art conglomerate kind of exists in Dublin now, and all of us were together in the same like youth theatre play when we were 15 in 2004. Like we were all in a play that John Morton wrote called Sherlock Holmes and the Cult of Dracula, and we're all still working today. It's very strange. So
who did you play?
I played Vampire Number 3.
Vampire Number 3
was my first role. Yeah, and that was the first time I did anything on stage.
Right.
So I kind of grew up in, there was a company down in Kilkenny, a youth company called Young Irish Filmmakers, which is still running today. And they had a youth theatre called Dream Stuff Youth Theatre, which is still running today, but they're like separate entities now. So all through my teenage years, I was at lunchtime at school lunchtimes and after school every day, I was like in that building, like messing around with cameras and theater stuff and scripts. And yeah, so
that sounds wonderful.
We were just all there. That's where we all came from, really. You know,
that's idyllic. And what did you did you ever get to write a play when you were younger, or what was your were you mainly into acting? Or
When I started acting, I was kind of writing in school, but I was writing very much in the way that we had in my secondary school, there was a nice creative writing kind of after schools thing that one of the English teachers had set up.
Yeah.
So I was doing that, but I was writing like poems, you know?
Yeah,
I
yeah, didn't, yeah.
Like, the idea of like writing a film hadn't really occurred to me. And then there was this, you know, youth club that a lot of people were going to. And I was like, let's go there and meet new friends, because I had the same friends every day in school since I was six.
Yeah.
So met a whole bunch of people who were also doing stuff like writing, but it was all geared around filmmaking and theater because of this. So I kind of initially there, I was like, I can do scripts because that's what I've done before this. I'm like a writer. And then they were literally, the reason I was in that Sherlock Holmes play was because they were short of cast members.
Right.
And then once I was doing that, I was like, ooh, this please.
Really?
Yeah, and it was a long, like, I remember when I was a teenager, like, I was not a natural on stage, you know, like I wanted to do it, but I really had to like learn it, you know. Writing came much more naturally to me than performing did.
Right.
Because I think I was doing, when I was performing, I was very much like doing an impression
of a performer?
Yeah, or like other people who were performing beside me. I was just kind of trying to do what I thought they were doing, as opposed to just figuring out, you know, what it was about myself that could be fun on stage.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to kind of click that. Because I think when you initially, like, especially when you're a teenager and you're like going through, like, they send you to like speech and drama lessons and that kind of thing, you suddenly like, you're introduced to this like, oh, it all must be proper acting, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of what I think.
Did you have that like big rainbow parachute?
Look at the audience and oh, yeah. No, we never had one of those. But the crazy thing about filmmakers was that like can I swear on your podcast?
Yeah, go for it.
Like we just fucking swore in everything we made.
Really?
Like it was just like we were all just making like mob films. We were all like, yeah, got to put the fucking drugs in the table. Like it was all just every film was Pulp Fiction. Like everything we made was just the filthiest, like most underthought out.
Yeah.
Like guns and swearing and drugs and drinking. It was just all there, and nobody ever stopped us. So
that's
what we did. And
it's like you're playing with hammers and they didn't stop you.
Yeah, it like broke the mold of it. So then like in Dream Stuff, which was the name of our youth theater.
Did you name Dream Gun after?
Nothing to do with Dream Gun, because I didn't have anything to do with coming up with the name for Dream Gun, but it's weird to me that it feels like Dream Stuff was like, you know, the S Club Juniors version of Dream Gun. But I remember in my Leaving Cert I was writing Christmas of my Leaving Cert, I was writing an adaptation of Around the World in 80 Days that went out as like our Christmas play that year at the same time I was like studying for my Leaving Cert.
Whoa.
So yeah, by then, that was the first like full-length play that I wrote. I wrote it with a friend of mine named Philip Brennan, who I still write stuff with every now and then. He's still in Kilkenny. So that was like the first play that I wrote. And after that, I kind of didn't stop. I always had something on the go.
Yeah. And where did you go to college?
Initially tried to go to drama school in London.
Did you?
Yeah, I was there for 2 months before I hit the old November crash and burn.
Yeah.
So I just didn't really know what I was doing.
Did you have to audition for that?
I did, yeah, I did. And it was another one of those kind of like, oh, I got it, so I have to do it. Because when I went to audition for it, I wasn't even sure if it was somewhere I wanted to go. And then when I got the audition, I don't even know if it was actually rare that you got it. You know what I mean? But they certainly sold it to me that way. And a lot of me felt like, oh, now that I've gotten it, I have to do it. It's a bit like those people who get 600 points in the Leaving and think they have to do medicine.
And then you know? They realize they have like a bit of a breakdown and stuff. Yeah, and I was like, so you kind of had a crash and burn with London. Like, what was the point that you realized that you had to move or... did you want to do?
I remember there was some point I was just like in a class and I knew I should be having a good time, but I wasn't. We were doing like a comedy class and it just like wasn't fun to me. And I was like, everyone else is having fun and I'm not. And I'm not sure if this is what I want to do. And then I just kind of went home.
Yeah.
Like I didn't even really formally leave the college. I just sort of stopped showing up.
Oh.
You know? I just kind of left. Then the next year, I just spent another year in Kilkenny. And then the next year I started in DIT, in the Conservatory of Music and Drama. I was like, all right, I'll give it another go, because I had a few friends who'd started there the year before.
Mm.
And I really couldn't tell you. I remember like going to classes in DIT that were the same classes that I'd done in London a year previously. And I really couldn't tell you what changed about me that meant that I was suddenly enjoying them, but I definitely was.
Yeah.
And then I just stuck with it. So yeah, then in the middle of DIT, I spent a bit of time in Chicago in Columbia College doing drama over there. And that was
Whoa.
super, that kind of defined me, I think, a bit from then on as a performer, because like working over there.
Because they have things like Second City, is that what
Yeah,
it?
well, our comedy show at the end of our semester of comedy was performed in Second City, so it was just like a little more to clued in to the industry, if that makes sense, than some of the drama schools over here can be very disconnected from what it's actually like to be a performer in Dublin. Whereas in Columbia and Chicago, one of the rules they had was that all the teachers have to also be working part time in theater in or in their in the in the thing that they're teaching in some degree. So you kind of got a much more honest and frank,
That's clever.
view of what it's actually like. Yeah, so I learned like improv and sketch over there, and then when I came, that's where I saw the Neo-Futurists for the first time. And then when I came back, I was kind of keen to. I was like a year away from graduating, and what I wanted to do, I can now define as what Dreamgun became. But at the time, I was like, I just know that I want to really try comedy stuff that isn't just stand-up. I'd done a little bit of stand-up while I was in college, and I hadn't enjoyed it the way that I enjoyed theater because they're completely different beasts, and I knew after seeing like the sketch and improv stuff in Chicago, I was like, I want to do something like that where it's like a team of people up there and we're in it together and it's like fun for us, and then just kind of chasing that ended up creating this a little bit, at least one quarter of it at least.
That's cool.
Yeah,
That's so
yeah.
cool. I was gonna ask you about, do you do serious roles or kind of like what's the other elements of acting that you do apart from Dream Gun now?
Yeah, well, Dreamgun has. It's funny. It's funny, isn't it? When I came out of college, all I initially did was serious roles. I played.
Really?
Yeah, I did a Shakespeare. I did I did an opera in Liverpool in March 2013, which was 2 months after I graduated,
You
where
did
I
an
played
opera.
the. Yeah, I did the Threepenny Opera for the European Opera Centre. I did. There's always a lot of operas have. The best example is the opera of A Midsummer Night's Dream has one actor in it playing Puck, who just performs. And this kind of adaptation of Threepenny Opera had one actor in it who just performed, and I got it somehow.
How does that feel to be like a performer, like in an opera? Because I feel like people come for the opera.
Yeah,
So what was the.
it was great because I don't, what it was. The guys who were directing it was a French director, and he didn't really, he was just there for the opera, and I was kind of left off to my own devices. So I kept doing comedy in it because this was like right after I'd done those two other serious plays, and I was kind of dying to be a bit funny in something. So I just completely turned the character into this, like, it was a play within a play setup. So I was like the director of the opera, director in inverted commas. Of the opera that you were seeing. So all it was I would just run in when things went wrong, in inverted commas, and would give out to everyone. So I just turned him into like a comedy character, as a comedy pretentious director character, as opposed to someone to be taken seriously. So that was kind of fun because it just meant I was getting laughs, but also I was like standing next to these insanely like much more physically trained performers than I was, because they're all like very intense, specific singers. And there was a couple of people that I met there who was just, I remember there was a moment where the lead guy who was playing Mac the Knife, his name was
Back the knife.
his name was Alex, and he was hidden in the Greek chorus at the back of the stage for the whole show. And then when he came out for his first thing, he would start singing with the chorus, and then the reveal was that he was actually hiding in them the whole time. And he was so damn good that you could tell it was him from the second the song started, because he was just a level better than everyone else sitting down, and I used to look at him coming out of it and just think, what a pro.
What an absolute pro.
Yeah, and then like not long after that was when I got in touch with Gavin and James, who I'd kind of known through when I was like making films when I was a teenager, and we would go to the Fresh Film Festival to show them. I remember there was one year that James and Connor Barry they won the festival and we won the audience award at it. So I was kind of aware they existed. And I was like, oh, I think I want to get back on that buzz again. Like, I think that's what, because I'd gone through all this college of like, here are the rules, I'd done all that. I'd done these serious plays, and I was like, I miss what I was doing when I was a teenager, where it was like, what if there's drugs in it? So I kind of sought them out because I knew they were in Dublin, and right around when Firehouse Film Festival started, we just kind of naturally gravitated towards each other and started making films together.
You were so funny in the Firehouse Film Festival.
It was fun, yeah.
It was great heady times.
it's incredible what Firehouse did for just like filmmakers here who were, even people who were like making stuff and putting it on YouTube, they could never be in a room with a bunch of people watching their films, and the crazy motivation that gave everyone to like make films, you know, that's kind of still happening now.
Yeah.
It was great. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a joy. I remember being on a bus with you.
Yeah.
And like, it was just when Dream Gun was starting and the film reads and stuff.
Yeah. This after Cat Laughs, was it?
Yeah, Cat
Laughs.
Yeah. And just how things changed so much for you within like 2 months of being on that bus of just like you were signed and then
because we were just down in another comedy group's entourage for that Cat Laughs, like we weren't performing at it.
I was
just there.
But you grew up around Cat Laughs, didn't you?
Yeah, I grew because Cat Laughs obviously is in Kilkenny, so I worked the merchandise stand in the box office for Whoa. 4 summers in Cat Laughs.
What was that like?
Super fun. It was very much being in the middle of something that like I really enjoyed, because I've never seen as much stand up again in my life as I saw every summer at Cat Laughs. The same way that when I was a teenager, you could put the shittest book in front of me and I would read the whole thing cover to cover, no problem. Mm. Whereas now, if you give me something good, it'll take me months to get through it. You know, I could just soak things up back then, and I would just see like 40 stand up sets. Like over the course of the week, every Cat Laughs for 4 years, to the point that my knowledge of the acts that I saw like back then, like this is ending around 2008, kind of kept me in the loop for years. Up until recently, when suddenly people started mentioning comedians, and I had no idea who they were, and it's because they weren't a thing in 2008.
Yeah.
And I've had to like deliberately watch like all the Netflix specials just to like top my knowledge up again. But in terms of just like seeing so much comedy. And also being a little bit backstage. I remember there was one time myself and my friend Philip, who I mentioned earlier, there used to be two clubs in the Cat Laughs.
Yeah.
Two after show clubs. One was the one that like everyone who had any kind of pass went to.
Yeah.
And then the other was the one that only the performers and like the real high up producers and the sponsors went to. So we were always like, that's the room. That's the real room, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember myself and Philip conspired to get into it and got in. And we were like, oh my God, it's happening. We went in. And suddenly I remember there was only about 30 people in it. All of them like, you know, worldwide famous comedians. And they all turned to look who came into the room. And they all just gave us a look that was like, you're not supposed to be in here at all.
Oh,
and then we stood in the corner for half an hour and left. And I remember, oh man, yeah. So it was always just like that. It was like.
But you always think those rooms are like class, and then you get into them and you're like, oh, it's just people.
Oh, it's just people.
Especially
doing the old. Oh, sorry.
Even famous people.
And they're looking behind you, looking at who's coming through the door as they're talking to you. Oh man. Yeah.
It's disgusting, and yet I probably do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, oh yeah,
I'd be
absolutely.
Like, I'd hate if I did.
Well, that's absolutely like my. It's also like. Like when I'm in that bloody room, it's just producer me, you know. That's you're like, I have to have a certain amount of conversations in here before I can relax, you know.
So when you did the first Cat Laughs, I feel like you got loads of different comedians involved, like international ones.
Yeah.
How did you go about the process of kind of hunting them down and choosing them?
Well, what was great was it was Dan and Matt who run the Cat Laughs. It was their idea to put the show together in the first place.
Brilliant.
So what was great was that we didn't have to go to them. They kind of came to us. So already we were in a good starting point because we just had the full power of them behind us. But essentially what happened was they were trying to come up with a show themselves that would like put all the, put more than one comedian on stage, you know, which obviously in stand-up you get all these comedians together for a festival, but you never get to see them all at once.
Yeah.
And they had like a loose idea that they hadn't developed at all, which was, what if we did a panto where half the people in it were actors and the other half were comedians who hadn't prepared. And then they hadn't thought any more than like literally just that sentence. And then the September before the first Catlass they did, they came to see us in Dublin Fringe doing Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And they basically were like, do you want to take this to Catlass? Except it's just you guys, the kind of core Dream Gun guys and comedians from the festival filling it out.
Amazing.
Obviously, I was like, yes. Oh, you know, obviously doing the Catlass, having worked there was a big goal of mine. So then we just like, basically all we did was, I knew people, Matt and Dan knew people, I made a cast list for Back to the Future, I made an ideal
kind of,
here's my first choice, gave it to Matt, there was a few people straight away, Matt and Dan were like, nope, yeah. not even going to ask, you know, and then, then it was just, we just put it to, I asked some people directly myself, because I started to kind of get to know people, and Matt and Dan went through agents and asked other people. And then slowly it came together, you know.
Yeah.
And then I think after the first year, it was much easier to do it the second year because, like, the comedians who had performed in it
had put
a good word in for us in the meantime, you know. So that was really nice.
Oh.
So, yeah, but it's real. Like, Jaws this year, one of the things we learned from Back to the Future last year was that we need kind of a core, it's a tough thing to do film reads for the first time,
yeah,
you know, and especially if you haven't seen the show or you don't know what it is, which is like the case with a lot of these comedians just coming and being given a script and just when your line comes up, read it.
Yeah.
You
know?
So what we did this year was, based on the previous year, the mistakes we made in the previous year, was we always made sure that there was always someone who knew how to do the show on stage at all times with the people who were fresh to it, to kind of just show them how to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that like first 30 minutes of Jaws, I was like really, really just sitting there, because I wasn't in it much. I was like sitting back in the chairs. I was just like really happy with how every scene was going, because it wasn't always just like someone like, you know, me or Gavin or Ronan that was in those scenes. It was people like Steen Raskopoulos,
yeah,
who was a guest, but he had done the show so many times before that he could be like a reliable pillar in the show. You know? So yeah, it's been real nice, like developing a slightly different version of the show that takes that into account. You know?
And you're doing a kids' version
of
the show as well. I should say, by the way, if we've been talking about this, for people that are listening to the podcast and don't know what Dream Gun film reads is, it's basically, I know it's a bit late now, but basically what it is like a group of people do an unrehearsed script film read.
Yeah.
So they kind of rewrite it.
Massively changed the script.
Yeah. Massively. So with The Lion King, because that's the kid show that's coming up.
Yeah.
How have you approached that?
We decided that we just wouldn't change anything. And then at the end, we're going to take the swearing out. That's what we're going to do. Because it's funny, we've done the show for kids before by accident.
Really?
Yeah,
what happened?
We did Body and Soul last year. We read Harry Potter. It was one of my favorite shows we've ever done. But it was on at 2 p.m. in the day. So obviously all the hippie parents that had their kids at Body and Soul were like, oh, there's a thing on at 2 p.m. called Harry Potter. I'll bring the kids to that. So it really was like 50-50, like adults and kids. And that was one where we just left the swearing in because we didn't know until we like literally walked out.
Oh, my God.
And we had a great time, you know. So kind of since then, I've been like, maybe we should think about intentionally, you know, from the ground up, because we were like, oh, we could do it again with Harry Potter. But if we change one that we already have, so that there's two versions of it, it's just going to be messy. So let's just make one from the ground up. So we settled on The Lion King. And really, really the one thing that we're taking into account while we're writing it, which is something we've been doing anyway, it's something that we've learned to do, is it's going to be a little bit shorter, and it's going to spend more time in scenes that you remember.
Okay.
You know,
so that
you always have like a clear picture in your head
of
like where we are and what's going on.
How are you going to address the death of Mufasa? Because that's the biggest thing I remember, is like my teacher bringing a TV on wheels with a VCR, and the whole class destroyed after Mufasa dies.
I think we're going to just go for it.
Dude.
I think we're just going to go. It's funny. We did Titanic in Edinburgh a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And people are always genuinely sad when Jack dies in our dumb, silly version of it. because he, you know, and we're making jokes about it, but it always comes from what the film originally was, you know, and if the film originally was this like really sad scene, we don't change that, you know, so it will be that with jokes. the big problem for us this time around has been the songs. So we're still not quite sure. I mean, we write it right up until the day that we do it. We've not quite figured out how we're going to do that. Might just not do them, but we'll see. We'll see.
Is there any film reads? Is there any film that you've tried to film read and it hasn't worked?
We know straight away. What we always do is we watch the film. That's the moment we think like, oh, this one, and we put it on, and we usually know within about 20 minutes if it's going to work or not. And the example I always use is the one that didn't work was Face Off. We were like,
that's a great film.
Yeah, it's a great film. And we were like, absolutely, it's ridiculous. And like a minute into that, there's that crazy bit where Nicolas Cage throws his hands out. Is he singing or is he screaming? I can't quite remember. But the film lingers on it because it knows how silly it's being.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, our narrator doesn't work unless the film is taking itself seriously.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of where the line is that the film has to believe in itself or else what we're saying is like completely moot, you know?
Okay.
So that's kind of where the line is. Although, you know, I remember there was one point where we thought we could never do Die Hard or Toy Story or Lord of the Rings, and we've done them all since. So
nice.
We're learning new ways to do it every time, you know?
What ones would you like to see Dream Gun film reads kind of make? Like
Everyone's mad for Jumanji. I'm aware of this. And I hope that maybe we'll get there. But we've been throwing around, like, because we're finishing up season two of the podcast we've recorded it already, but it's going to be The Shawshank Redemption, and that's coming out next week.
Wow.
And then we're going to be taking a break off until next year is basically when the next episode is going to come out.
So you've come up with a full, what, like 12 more films?
We did 7 this season and we intended to do 6, so we've shortened it down. It's about six a season.
Okay.
But for season 3, we're kind of like, maybe we just need to really mess with the premise of this thing a bit. Maybe we need to do stuff that like people aren't expecting, because now that we're playing like a variety of venues, you know, if we're doing Vicar Street, obviously we're going to do Lord of the Rings, but if we're doing a smaller room in Vodafone, let's try out Shawshank Redemption, because less people are going to be interested in seeing it, but enough people will come to fill out the room. So we're kind of playing with that as the shows come along now. We're like, there's an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation that we really want to do. And it would be, I don't even know how, normally it's like, film reads is like a fun opportunity for you to maybe watch a film you haven't seen or like maybe revisit it. And people usually watch the show coming up to the reading, you know, in the last 2 days. I don't even know where to begin to like tell people how to prep for. We're doing one very specific episode of Star Trek.
Could you do that like Comic Con or something?
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. And that's the thing. It's kind of, we're waiting for the offers to come in, and then we kind of decide what would work. Hold off on making the decision until we see where we're going.
You know? Offered.
Yeah, yeah.
Stephen, that's me. Thank you so much. It was so lovely chatting
to you.
Thank you
for having me.
That was Stephen Culver there. He's amazing. My tour, Alison Spittle, I'm bringing Mother of God on tour. It's a show about revenge. It's a show about how I didn't get the part of Mary in the school nativity play and how not to hold grudges. I'm very excited about it. I've just got the dates, actually. Will I read them out to you? I'll read them out to you. So let's see. I'll just make sure they're definitely confirmed. Do-do-do. Okay, so I can definitely tell you, I'm doing Liberty Hall in Dublin. I'm super, super excited about doing that. It's March 21st, Liberty Hall, March 21st. And I'm really, really excited about that. I'm doing, here we go. Okay. This is exciting. I'm going to be doing Debarra's in Clonakilty, which is an amazing show. I just love the bars. I love going down there. They give good soup. They do ham and cheese. And I'm super excited about doing the bars. And that's on March the 19th. And then I'm going to be in Dingle for the Animation Festival on March 20th. And then March 21st, I'm going up to Liberty Hall in Dublin. That's a Saturday. Then I'm going to be in Rathof on the 27th of March. And Saturday, April 19th, that's a while away, I'm going to be in Spirit Store in Dundalk. And then Dolan's in Limerick on April 23rd and Central Arts Waterford on April 24th. If you're in a town which I'm not going to and you really want me to come, please tweet me and I'll see what I can do. I'm going to sort out getting a Cork date as well because I feckin' love doing Cork. You were brilliant at the Cork Podcast Festival, which is a great festival. Thank you so much. And also, I really want to do Belfast, and I will be doing that soon, and Galway. There's a secret bigger, well, not like, okay, I can't tell you, it's a secret, but I'll probably tell you at the next podcast. So the 16th of November is the day that I'm doing the Dublin Podcast Festival. Alison Spittle Show, Mia Dunphy and Julie J. Julie J is simply the funniest comedian in Ireland, in my opinion. And it's an absolute crying shame that I haven't had her on before. I kind of wanted to have her on with an audience because she just excels. And then Mia Dunphy is an amazing lady. She's done so much cool shit. Like, I have this kind of obsession with Mr. Tato, and she helped write the Mr. Tato biography. So I got so much questions for her. She's on TV all the time, and she's just an incredibly accomplished woman. And yeah, come, it's bring your own drink. I'm going to bring, I think I'm going to go old school. I think I'm going to get like fat frogs for myself. So you bring whatever you want. There's a spa really nearby. It'll be a lot of fun. Thank you so much to Sarah Garvey, who makes the podcast. Without her, I'd be fecked. Thank you so much to Alan and Patty from Headstuff. Headstuff are brilliant. Thank you so much to William Conway, who did the artwork. And Bobby Ahern from No Monster Club, who did the theme tune. And he's got some new music out. Think his new name is Sir Bobby Jukebox, and go check that stuff out. I hope you have a lovely day, and thank you so much for listening to me. Next podcast I'll be more coherent. Yeah, you know what, I was gonna apologize, but I'm not. I'm just gonna let you go. Have a lovely day. I miss Ireland. Okay, bye.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.